I think this thing's working now, which means, I suppose, that we can think about getting started. You have some paperwork there, and I've got some paperwork here. I don't know if you want to close the door.
Okay. Ms. Taylor, what kind of format do you think about? Do you think in terms of asking questions?
Well, yeah.
And you responding?
Just starting out with...
You have... Now, let me tell you that I have had... We had a flu shot 2 weeks ago.
Oh, boy.
In Ball, Iowa. Odell and I both wondered whether all the bacteria, the viruses were killed or not in there.
Yeah.
Stuff,
This is what I was dealing with.
Because we've been under the weather ever since.
Oh, my.
And we're just getting out of it. In fact, last night for the first time, I wasn't taking medication last night. I was taking medication every night.
Well, those deals where you wonder if the disease is worse than the cure.
I don't know that I can really blame that. I probably shouldn't blame the flu shot on it. But anyhow.
Okay, well, let's shuffle a whole lot of paper here and get back to where we need to be, which I think is right about here.
You got that, you got the outline?
Yeah. Yeah, this is all good material that we need for the get started. Now then, I thought I checked this file before I started, and I have an outline here somewhere. I may have to borrow that one back.
Okay, now here's the one
that's here, I think.
Yeah. Starts off with CD.
No,
that's the list of things that you wanted.
Here we
get to the stock.
Here we go.
The stock interview, the oral history outline.
Yeah. I think one of the things that I think is particularly interesting about this business is the idea that, particularly in mass spectrometry at the time you guys came into it, it was an unknown area. And so you're really pioneers. And I think the early background, these people, you know, parental background and education and attitude towards science and that kind of stuff is important because it was a whole new field. So I don't know. Tell me a little bit about
it. Let me ask this.
Okay.
I sent you this, which I rewrote.
Yeah.
So you can tell I've already retired here. Which,
yeah.
So this, do I need, we don't need to go with this, do we?
No, I think this is like represents the supporting documentation.
And
I think if there's any, we need, in other words, this is kind of very factual information on, right. on the CV. I think what we're interested in here at this particular point is more anecdotal things, like when I... talked to Dr. Neer, he brought up the point that one of his professors picked him out of his physics class and after the third exam, you know, and started muscling him to go into physics, that kind of thing, rather than, I mean, this is information that's necessary, but what we're really interested in is the kind of personal, anecdotal...
wondering is, this is going to go in some sort of archive someplace,
that's
right?
Correct.
Will this be included automatically?
Yes.
That's the point.
Yes.
I don't need to go over this because this is already a part of it.
Yeah. Right. All the documentation you sent me is the beginning of a file that will go with the transcript, and that'll all be supporting documentation.
Mm-hmm.
So mostly we want to discuss is the interactions and the things that you don't normally write about.
Are you picking up now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're recording information. So, you know, a lot of times you just don't talk about or put on in hard copy some of the influences that happened to you early in life or something like that. So I don't know if, you know, you had any of those experiences during your education and background.
Well, let me start off with family background.
Yeah.
So we'll go through the...
Sure.
Through your outline here.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that most of the Lumpkin people were supposed to be school teachers. My parents, his brothers, sisters, their spouses were all public school teachers, and it seemed like they almost invariably went to Southwest Texas in San Marcos for school. So obviously Earl was expected to go there also to school. I've got one older brother or the younger brother. The oldest one is still alive. He's a chemist. In fact, the fact that he was a chemist and went to Southwest Texas persuaded me to go to Southwest Texas and take chemistry. Because when you are reared in the family of a school teacher in Texas during the Depression, you know very soon that you do not want to be a school teacher, because things were very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. Back in those days, my father was always a superintendent of schools or principal of an elementary or a high school, and even in spite of fairly high level there, they still moved around. Not these days, you go to work for a school district and you can spend an entire career at that one school district. Back in those days, you were elected by the board of trustees and you moved around. So as a result, I saw what the life of a school teacher was, and I did not want to be a school teacher. So when I enrolled in Southwest Texas, I deliberately took no courses in education so I could never ever be tempted to teach school. Let's see.
But why didn't you say that your older brother success in chemistry, interest in chemistry, influenced you to follow chemistry?
Yeah, because he also decided the same thing. Mm-hmm. He didn't want to be a school teacher. Neither did my younger brother want to be a school teacher. Mm-hmm. These three boys living in a school teacher's family during the Depression days, and always having a garden and raising chickens and having a cow and all the things that you need to do to get by on the school teacher's salary, just made us realize that we did not want to be in this profession. So as a result, I went to school to five different elementary and high schools during the time that we moved around, and I finally graduated from a relatively small high school, Pollendale High School in San Antonio, Texas. So I'm a Central Texas man. I guess the influential people, obviously, are my parents. The fact that they were educated. All of my forebears on my father's side were educated.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned from them the value of an education. In fact, my father, Charles Everett Lumpkin, his oration, this is what they called it in those days, his oration on graduation from Tyvee High School in Kerrville, Texas in 1912 was the value of an education.
Mm-hmm.
And I still got his handwritten copy of his oration that he gave to the senior high school graduating class in 1912. So it was always a given that all of us were going to go to college.
Okay.
But we might pursue
whatever you wanted.
Different areas. No, not wherever you wanted. I always wanted to go to the University of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
But finances were such that we ended up in San Marcos.
Okay, well, Texas is a state school, right? I mean, University of Texas. But there was just the problem of room and board. And
room and board and a place to live.
Yeah, and, okay. So it wasn't the cost of the education, per se. It was the cost of the living, really.
Back in those days, the state schools were... For residents was...
So if you had been able to stay with a relative or something like that, then it would have been... Yeah, okay. So the cost of education was really the cost of living in that situation.
But let me tell you something about... Also was impressive to me. Now, back in the old days, I'm talking about the 1910 to 1925, an ambitious young man or woman graduating from high school with good grades could go to one summer normal school and the next fall start teaching in the public school systems. All right. So that means that my father started teaching school right after he graduated from high school, but he still wanted an education. So that means every summer, year after year, no matter where we were, he would pack up his family, come to San Marcos, rent a house or some rooms, go to summer school, get a few semester hours of credit, go back and teach at his school for the long term, come back to San Marcos again. So every year I went back and forth from where we were back to San Marcos again. And he finally got his Bachelor of Science degree. He started his teaching school down in about 1918 and 1920.
Mm-hmm.
He finally got his bachelor's degree in about 1929, and he got his master's degree in about 1932. I even spent one summer in a tent in San Marcos on college property because he couldn't find a place to rent.
Yeah.
Well, that's
interesting.
That's my idea of impressing on a child the value of an education.
Yeah.
When the man will take his family, and they were three boys, though,
yeah,
take his family and just move them every summer.
Yeah, that does make an impression.
So that's again one of the reasons why I went to Southwest Texas, and again primarily it was financial.
So, but the interest in chemistry, that was, you just decided to kind of follow along on your older brother?
My older brother, that's right.
Didn't really have any burning desire, other than it looked like it was kind of, I mean, he seemed to be doing well with it, and you thought,
well,
he was with it.
I guess I was interested in the scientific field as a kid. Gosh.
Okay.
When I was in the fifth grade and earlier, this was the days before, except people who had some affluence could purchase a radio.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So what does Earl do? He builds himself a crystal set radio.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an old gentleman named Algie Devaney, who lived in the little town of Martindale, just outside of San Marcos, about 7 miles, he would come by the school and he would sell us these galena crystals.
Mm-hmm.
And he would tell us how to make a crystal set radio.
Mm-hmm.
So all during my boyhood days, I was interested in, you know, in science and radio, electricity, and
mm-hmm.
things of this nature. This also obviously bent me towards the chemistry field. In fact, when we moved from Martindale down to Oak Island, just below San Antonio, we moved into a teacherage which had no electricity in the home.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this means kerosene lamps. We, by then, we had a radio.
Mm-hmm.
We had no Atwater Kent radio.
Mm-hmm.
I wired the entire house, which was three bedrooms in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
I wired the entire house for a crystal set radio. I remember my Aunt Josie gave me $15 for Christmas one year, and I went down and bought a pair of headphones. The rest of them had to listen through an old telephone receiver, the handheld earpiece.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I set up the crystal set radio in my brother's and I bedroom, and I would run wires in a drop card, the old drop card ceiling, down where you could plug in these headphones. Everything was, or the receivers, everything was fine until you plug in about 4 or 5, then the signal got so faint.
Yeah.
And with that $15, I bought a variable capacitor. Finally, I was able to tune in WOAI and separate it from KTSA. Those are both two strong San Antonio radio stations. Before, it was kind of a mishmash, which one was the loudest signal, you hear that.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting anecdote.
Well, I remember I used to live in Laredo, and that was one of the things.
XCR down there.
Well, but Mother got hung on WOAI. We used to get that a lot, you know, at the right time of the day or evening or whatever. And so she always is a news buff, so I'm familiar with WOAI because we used to listen to that all the time.
Let's see. So that's a lot of the reasons why I was involved in science. And while I was at Southwest Texas, I took practically every science course that they had there in the field of physics, chemistry, mathematics.
Okay, so in other words, the curriculum was essentially that they had a lot of different science courses. If you got a degree in chemistry, did they actually have a curriculum that had certain requirements for a chemistry degree, or did you just take a large spectrum of
basic science courses with a little extra in chemistry.
I took all the courses in chemistry that were offered, and so actually it was a Bachelor of Science degree.
Okay.
With a major in chemistry and a minor in physics and mathematics. And there were no great professors there. Dr. C.L. Key, I think, was probably my favorite chemistry professor. Mm-hmm. These were all doctorate type professors. It was, they were happy days, obviously, as an undergraduate there living at home. I was a townie, of course. I wasn't wasn't on campus a great deal.
So you were able to complete your education in a standard 4-year undergraduate.
After 3.5 years, because I live around there, so I went to school summer school also.
Sure.
Right.
As opposed to your dad, who just
he took
a long
25 years.
Yeah.
To get his education.
So basically, I'm sure in the chemistry there was, how modern was the chemistry? In other words, was it pretty much up to date with regard to the kind of tools you ended up using, or did they even mention them, or do you recall? Or?
Well, no. Now, we're talking about
Talking
about 1937 to 1941.
Okay.
Even though this is a teacher's college, they had, very up-to-date laboratory apparatus.
Mm-hmm.
Mind you now, this is, nobody ever heard of a mass spectrometer in a college laboratory in those days, before World War I.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have anything like what we call modern instrumentation. It was primarily wet chemistry.
Okay. So it was it was a good solid founding in chemistry, but it didn't give you any inkling of what you were going to get into.
Exactly. No. In fact, I had never heard of a mass spectrometer until I started to work for Hum Law and Refining Company. So then came almost 4 years of military service. In the, I graduated actually in February 1941 because I had been to summer school, and now 1941, age 21. Obviously, this is the days of the draft, and I'm 1A, which means if my number comes up, I'm going to be in the military, and maybe in a role in the military that I didn't particularly care for.
Mm-hmm, I understand.
So I went to work for the Texas State Department of Health here in Austin, and there came a recruiting group from the Air Force through. So I took off a half a day, ate about 3 or 4 pounds of bananas in order to up my weight, because I only weighed about 135 pounds.
Sounds familiar.
And went down and took the physical exam and forgot about it. That was in July, and sure enough, in October, I got greetings saying I was going to go to the Air Force, which was fine with me, rather than the infantry or something like that. So mm-hmm. I spent my military career in the Air Force. I went to UCLA in meteorology, took courses in advanced meteorology at UCLA.
So their interest in you was the fact that you did have a bachelor's degree. I can see that you graduated high in your class.
Yes.
So they wanted to continue your education in a
new field.
In a new field, but in something that they needed.
They needed everyone who came into the Air Force Meteorology, the early classes in the Air Force Meteorology School, all had to have science degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Before they even started into the meteorology.
Okay.
So
it's kind of like almost like a graduate study.
Right.
Program.
So this is a graduate course there, and I ended up in the Caribbean, South America, and then again took some additional graduate courses in meteorology at University of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they set up a campus in San Juan, Puerto Rico.
Okay.
And I spent some months there.
Extension campus.
Exactly.
So. They just needed people to do weather forecasting, is that it?
Exactly.
To be weather-wise, or, right?
Well,
weather is
you know, important. If you understand the field of meteorology, yes. It is a science.
Yeah.
It's not an exact science like mathematics, but and there's some guesses involved, and we still know that, particularly when you're trying to forecast weather in South Texas. But I was forecasting weather in the tropics, where it's a little bit more easy.
Was the state of the art of weather forecasting at that time? Did you try and get a clear 24-hour? I mean, obviously the military had interest in the weather. Was it mostly for flying in terms of being able to have clear weather days,
well,
knowing whether there was going to be a storm come in while you had a group of pilots out?
Sure, all of that. Back when I graduated as a second lieutenant from UCLA, mm-hmm. in November 1942, the big push was getting planes over to North Africa, because this is when the invasion of North Africa happened in 42.
Mm-hmm.
And so they needed a lot of weather forecasters along the route from Miami
okay.
down to Puerto Rico, on down to South America, on down to Belém in Brazil, across to Ascension Islands, then on across to Dakar in North Africa. So they got the 9th Weather Squadron had weather forecasters and weather stations stationed all along the route of ferrying warplanes over and war wearies
okay.
back.
Sure.
So we're forecasting route information for
which is very critical, particularly for overseas flight, where if you have a problem, you got a problem.
Yeah.
You don't want to go on the drink.
And I was the base weather officer at most of my stations. In other words, I started off as being the only weather officer there,
mm.
and then moved to another station, and they had 3 or 4. By now I was a captain, and I had some second lieutenants under me. So,
mm.
so I had pretty good size operation.
Okay, so you really then, this was your tour of duty during the war?
41 to 45. So this cut into my education.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what happens? By the end of the war, I already had 2 children. I was lucky. Odell got pregnant while we was in UCLA. She's out there with me. I got married at midterm during cadet school.
Mm-hmm.
And the good old Army Air Force, it wasn't the Air Corps, it wasn't the Air Force, it was the Army Air Corps. The good old Army Air Corps, every cadet who got married during school was immediately sent overseas. Those who did not get married were given stateside assignments near their hometowns. I was sent overseas.
Mm-hmm.
But I was able to make some trips back once in a while. So by the time the war was over, I had 2 children. I had to earn a living. I could no longer go back to school to complete my education.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are. We're.
But you did have a bachelor's degree.
Oh yes.
And you had the postgraduate education in meteorology.
Yes.
And so you had intended actually to go on
in science.
In science and
exactly.
further graduate work. But now you had a lot of responsibility.
The Air Force wanted me to stay in as a career Air Force meteorologist,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
I decided very quickly that I was not cut out to be an Air Force permanent career.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
as soon as the opportunity was available, back in those days you got out on points, what your age was, how many years or months of service, how many children you had. So I was one of the very first people who released, which was very lucky, because when I came back with my degree, I was probably one of the first ones who were able to come in and get a professional
mm-hmm.
job and beat most of the rest of the,
sure.
the
you were right
returning
the,
soldiers.
Yeah, you were
right.
The earliest back, so that was a good portion.
So my first look for a job, because I like the Central Texas area,
mm-hmm.
like in and around Austin. I went to the State Highway Department. I knew that they hired chemists, you know, asphalt and hardness and all this sort of mess. They were not hiring. They says, sorry, not interested. And so I said, well, the next thing is Humble Oil and Refining Company. To me, Humble Oil and Refining Company was, you know, the big Texas oil company.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Houston. And
this was mid-40s, then, 45, 40?
This was fall of 1945.
Okay.
Fall of 45. Went down and put in my application in the big old Humble building in downtown Houston. And they took my application and sent it out to the Research and Development Division in Baytown. Mm-hmm. And about a week later, I got a telephone call to come down to interview. And I went down and interviewed with them. I hadn't been discharged yet from the Air Force. I mean, I was on terminal leave. Mm-hmm. I was still in uniform with captain's bars and looking very, very neat and trim, etc. Mm-hmm. And interviewed with the people at Humble R&D. And about 3 weeks later, I got a telephone call saying, yes, you're hired. So I went to work with Humble R&D Finding Company in the fall of 1945, and was immediately assigned to mass spectrometry.
Did they show that option to you as, you know, when you first interviewed, or was that, was that just...
Well, I took a general tour of the labs and saw the facilities, and I'm sure that they asked some penetrating questions about my knowledge of the physics and electricity and magnetism and electronics and things of this nature. And I don't think at the time that we interviewed, they said, we want you for this specific job. But when they called me and offered the job and I reported in, then they told me that I would be assigned to the mass spectrometry laboratory. Mm-hmm. There was one technical man in charge called, his name was Ben Thomas, B.W. Thomas. He was okay. The situation was that in about 1940, the first publication in you might say industrial mass spectrometry was a paper describing a consolidated mass spectrometer by Herbert Hoover Jr. Mm-hmm. And Harold Washburn. Okay, it turns out that they made an impression on a lot of petroleum people of what this instrument could do for the analysis of methane, ethane, propane, and actually be able to separate isonor and butane. Mm-hmm. So all the oil companies says, hey, this beats the old low temperature distillation procedure. We don't have one. So when I went to work for Exxon, I'm begging your pardon, Humble R&D Finding Company, later on Exxon, later on Esso, then Exxon.
No, oh, yeah.
They already had a 21-101 mass spectrometer, and they also had a Westinghouse mass spectrometer. They were just setting up and getting together a group of people to exploit the use of these instruments. Because back in those days, gosh, we're talking about a recording oscillograph. You take the photographic paper and put it in a dark sleeve and go to a dark room and develop it and dry it. And then you've got people who go through and number the peaks on the oscillograph and measure the peak height, put this on a piece of paper. And then you went through an extensive calculation that CEC very tediously taught you how to do with beautiful manuals. And you had inverted matrices, and as time went on and we expanded all the way from hydrogen through the C5s, you ended sometime with 18 or 20 components in an inverted matrix. Okay? Now, how do you get these inverted matrices? What you do is you use an old Friedin or Marchant hand calculator, and it took about 2 or 3 days to invert a 20 by 20 matrix. And this, you could use this then as long as the calibration data remained constant. Back in those days, the ionization chamber temperature was not controlled. It was very difficult to control the pattern and sensitivity of these various compounds, and we were analyzing for individual components, not for types.
What was the highest component you never looked at? The C4s or?
Well, with the 21-101, you could in one group, mixture, you could do hydrogen, CO, CO2, methane through the butanes, nitrogen, oxygen, H2S, water.
Okay.
ethylene, propylene, isoprene, the whole works.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, you were limited by the stopcock grease, of course, and the volatility of the material.
Mm-hmm.
If you actually had a separated material, you could analyze for individual isoprene pentane. You could analyze for individual C6s and the individual C4 olefins and C5 olefins.
Mm-hmm.
But not all in one big mixture.
Okay.
Had to have some separations. Shall I tell a story of the Westinghouse?
Yeah, I think so, because that was, well, first off, the CC machines were 180 degree magnetic
right.
sector instruments.
Yes.
Okay, and then Westinghouse was in the business, or got into the business. Do you know when started? Or
how Westinghouse got in the business was when Harold Washburn and Consolidated Engineering Corporation began to sell these mass spectrometers to these very eager petroleum companies, and I'm sure a few chemical companies also bought these mass spectrometers. They made you sign a contract that any scientific breakthroughs that you made using this equipment would be assigned to CEC. The oil companies were in a bind. They signed the contract on the first instruments that they bought, but they said, we have to break this. So there was a consortium of people. Ben Thomas was one of them, John Hipple was one, I think Norman Cardishaw, maybe D.P. Stevenson from Shell and Emeryville. They went to Westinghouse, a famous electrical company, and says, hey, we need to build a mass spectrometer that we can buy instead of the CEC and break this this patent
mm-hmm.
business. So this group of men, I may have some of the names wrong. I know that Ben Thomas is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Finnegan may have been one of them. I'm not really sure. But anyway, they spent about 2 years in Pittsburgh with Westinghouse, and they came out with the Westinghouse LV 90 degree instrument. And again, when I went to work for Humble had two Westinghouse mass spectrometers. No, these were laborious instruments. I mean, this, you read the signal with the light beam galvanometer.
Mm.
You sat on it, and you the light beam would deflect, and you would know about it, balance it down to a null, and read your K2 potentiometer to read the signal deflection.
Yeah, this sounds like a physics problem. You know, that's how Neer took a lot of his spectra.
Right.
By hand, the hard way. And this was still in 1945, even.
This is 45, 46. In fact, we used Westinghouse instruments clear up into the late 50s and early 60s. So we still using the Westinghouse. Because it was still a good, stable instrument. It had limited resolving power, 120. But with the compound, with the materials which you could vaporize at room temperature, that's all you needed anyway.
Yeah.
But you could vaporize and introduce through a gaseous inlet system till you got up into the liquids, and well, of course, you could put a little bit of liquid in and let it vaporize at room temperature, enough vapor pressure to read on a manometer.
Mm-hmm.
But when you got up into C6, C7, C8, you began to realize you have difficulties there. And so then, of course, what happened from there is you go into heated inlet system.
Mm-hmm.
You begin to realize that you need a heated inlet system.
Did the CEC instrument have a heated inlet system, or were they both essentially room temperature inlets? At
the 21-101 and the 21-102 were both room temperature inlet systems, gases only.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, people began to realize that if we heat up these inlet systems, get rid of the stopcock grease, I think Archie Hood and Jack O'Neill built an elevated temperature system.
So the problem with the stopcock grease is it would absorb compounds out of your sample mixture. So
well, so you got two things. First of all, you got absorption, so you got wrong results, and mm-hmm. second of all, you got memory effects with an example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then there's always the business of you got to shut down about a half a day every week, once a week, shut down, vent the entire system, and re-grease all your stock pumps.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they begin to get draggy and leaky.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I wanted to say this about the stability of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Normal butane was used to determine the sensitivity and the relative cracking pattern, like the 58 to 43 ratio, to determine what we call pattern,
mm-hmm.
the reproducibility of pattern. And when these change, well, then the analysis is off. And you mm-hmm. have to recalibrate for all these 20 gases or so. So CEC came out with a ionization chamber temperature controlling device. Have you ever seen one of these on a 21-101?
Mm.
It was a glass envelope in the first place. A glass envelope. In order to change filaments, you had to take the entire glass, the entire analyzer out of the magnetic field, break a wax seal, take out the ionization chamber, put in a new filament, insert the whole thing again. Well, anyhow, it was a glass portion of it, and on the outside of the vacuum, there was a parabolic mirror with a filament sitting in front of this, and there was a thermocouple on the ionization chamber. You try to maintain it slightly above what just the filament alone would maintain the temperature. So, of course, the thermocouple says, heat me up a little bit. A light would come on this parabolic mirror, which would shine through the glass envelope onto the ionization chamber, and it would heat the thing back up again. It would take hours, it seemed like, for to reach temperature stability.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine.
So this was some of the early days. The stopcock grease and and wax.
So then the use of the inlet system, the heat inlet system, was kind of natural evolution to get
sure.
into to the heavier compounds.
You got all sorts of natural evolutions.
Yeah, and you wanted to get a heated ion source that was heated other than just from stray filament heating.
Right. So obviously, as far as I'm concerned, the developments in mass spectrometry in the petroleum industry, and indeed probably throughout all of industry, started with CEC because they made the first instrument that was reproducible.
Mm-hmm.
Which I know that mass spectrometers were used before then for
sure.
isotope measurements and elemental atomic weights and things of this nature, but primarily it was just in the physics laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
This came into the chemistry laboratory now, when we finally got an instrument that had a reproducible pattern, and you could use it for actual analyses and identification
mm-hmm.
Of things.
Now you were going to say something about the stability of the instruments, the fact that...
Finally, of course, CEC realized that they had to improve things, so obviously they did. So this is a series of developments, not only in the in resolving power, in the stability of magnetic fields, stability of electronics, recording devices. We finally got into digitizers instead of the old recording oscillographs. So there's the entire field just kind of moved along together, and in the petroleum industry it moves to higher and higher boiling ranges.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that probably the C8s and C9s are about as far as you could go for individual component analysis, and after that you start into type analysis. In other words,
mm-hmm.
Total C5s, C6s, C7s, C8s, paraffins, naphthenes, aromatics, olefins, things of this nature. So
mm-hmm.
this started type analysis.
So the requirement for type analysis came from where, I understand the need for getting some analytical information about the various compounds, but the type analysis is giving you just more of a kind of a macroscopic view of what's out there. Type analysis was important and what... For what reason?
Oh, sure, because now you've got to realize that the oil companies these days were, it was a harsh and buggy days as far as the laboratory analyses of petroleum fraction, because petroleum is extremely complex. And the procedures that they used, if anything that was better and gave them information that they needed, they would latch on to it. And they discovered that the mass spectrometer, they could take a feedstock and run it through some sort of reforming process, look at the feedstock, look at the products, tell you that you've converted this much naphthenes to aromatics, this much high molecular weight paraffins into lower molecular weight olefins. All this sort of feed and product, studying pressures, temperatures, catalysis, and so forth, this is what we're involved in, and this is what the petroleum industry really used the mass spectrometer for.
So the type analysis really answered an even more important questions in the whole refining process.
Sure.
For
the only need for really individual component analysis in the lower boiling range is when you got into specialty products like toluene. If you're going to make a higher grade toluene for nitration grade TNT, nitration grade toluene to make TNT, then you want to be able to analyze specifically for that component. Or if you're going to go into making good gasolines with a lot of iso-octane in it, you need to be able to measure the branchiness of paraffins to get high octane ratings. Otherwise, type analysis was the answer as you went to higher and higher boiling material. Mm-hmm. So the mass spectrometer was a glove that fit a needed hand.
The problem now with Westinghouse, they how long did they last? I mean, in a commercial business.
I don't think that Westinghouse really ever had their heart in making money at it. I think they did sell quite a few of them. We purchased two and we use them to good effect.
These were also 180 degree.
They were 90 degree.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. That's right. I did mention 90 degree.
90 degree sector.
I guess they had to avoid the 180 degree design to not infringe on CDC's design.
I'm not sure about that part of it. Let's see.
But they did work for the job.
Yes, they worked for the room temperature materials, which were had enough vapor pressure at room temperature.
And they also worked to break CDC's strangleholds.
Exactly. In fact, Frank Field and Sam Hastings used the Westinghouse for their work in publishing the first paper on low voltage analysis. They actually used the Westinghouse instrument for that. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, as far as Hummel and Exxon are concerned, the low voltage procedure, both at low resolution and high resolution, has been the mainstay of what our major contributions have been in characterization of petroleum. That is, just being able to identify and analyze for, I mean, quantitatively analyze for benzenes, naphthalenes, phenanthrenes, crisines, and all the way from C6 to C50,
mm-hmm.
And all of the aromatic oxidative compounds and nitrogen and sulfur compounds, identifying those and analyzing for those, and being able then to tell the process people when they went through the different processes, this is what's happening in this process.
On the low voltage work that you mentioned, that was done when was it?
I think Sam Hastings and Frank Field's article came out in about 1956, and I published my first paper in 1958, extended it. Theirs is very limited. They were not interested in the analytical field primarily. They were interested in showing the possibility of a technique.
Mm, okay.
And then I took it because we were in the same laboratory,
mm-hmm.
and extended it onto analytical procedures.
Now, your initial work when you first started working in this laboratory, what did you do? I mean, here you hired in, you walked in the door, and he said, "Here, or I'll get to work."
Well, the first thing they did was hand me the CEC manual. Says, start reading this and understanding this instrument and what it can do and how to do it. And
were there any other people? I guess there must have been somebody there who knew how to run it.
Oh, sure. Ben Thomas was there.
And were there other people?
We had instrument technicians. We always had great instrument technicians. We began to take on quite a load of work. I'm talking about finally running three shifts a day of people analyzing samples. Mm-hmm. Okay, when you talk about three shifts a day and reading all these charts and running the instruments and doing all the calculations, I'd be in a room, maybe a 20 by 40 foot room with 8 or 10 Freedom calculators and 6 or 8 women and men sitting there reading charts and running through calculations. So this was a big operation.
The way it was when you first got on board.
Yes, within a very few months. I mean, we were up and running, mm-hmm. but they needed technical help. Mm-hmm. Ben Thomas was by himself.
Yeah,
they needed technical help in supervising these people and understanding and keeping the quality control, knowing what you were doing.
Sure.
Because although a lot of the people that we had Bachelor of Science, we very hardly hired anybody in as a research technician,
mm-hmm.
even without a bachelor's degree, which was good, of course, because they were high quality people.
Mm-hmm.
So I was lucky really to come in as a professional,
mm-hmm.
really.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. We were. I was very lucky to have some people involved in the laboratories at Exxon that were greatly interested in the field of mass spectrometry. I'm sure you know Joe Franklin.
Oh yes.
Joe Franklin was he was the first president of ASMS, for example.
Mm-hmm.
ASMS was organized in 1969. He was the first president. He was one of the men that I interviewed with in 1945.
Okay.
When I went to work with him. And so he had an, although he wasn't a mass spectroscopist, he was a scientist. One of his major interests was in the field of mass spectrometry. So he began to collect around himself, off and on over the years. Some came and some went, but over the years, of course, there was Joe Franklin and Frank Field, who was also a president of ASMS.
Mm-hmm.
There was Gene Futrell, who was also a president of ASMS. Fred Lamp. Bernie Munson, made quite a name for himself. Thomas Otzel, and myself. And a lot of these people would come and stay for a few years and then move on to some academic area. In fact, Joe Franklin himself left Humble and accepted the first Welch Foundation chair at Rice University.
Mm-hmm.
And he spent the rest of his career there. And Frank Field went to Rockefeller University.
Mm-hmm.
So we had quite a battery of people.
An impressive group, to be sure. One of the things that might be interesting to just track down for the record is this business. I know you mentioned Humble, Esso, and Exxon. Do you remember the dates and those changes and what the significance was? I mean, were there people, was there merging of oil companies, or just a name change, or was somebody buying somebody out or being bought? Or
yeah, well, Humble Oil Refining Company was founded about 1917 on the handshake of a few men in Humble, Texas. That's the reason why it's called Humble and not Humble.
Okay.
Humble. You pronounce the H. Humble, Texas. But apparently in the 1920s, they needed some money for development, and they sold about 53% of their stock to John D. Rockefeller, Standard Oil Company. But they still maintained their independence as a Texas institution. They had agreements as far as in the research area. They had, it was called the General Research Agreement. So there was an agreement between Standard Oil Development Company and Humble Research and Development Company on exchange of information. As the years went by, I think Standard Oil Company began to realize, hey, here is a valuable piece of property. We ought to buy some more of it. So they began to buy more and more stock of Humble Oil Refining Company. I owned Humble Oil Refining Company shares. I didn't own any Standard Oil Company shares for many, many years. And finally, in in 1953, Standard Oil began to buy up more and more Humble stock. And in about 1965, they acquired enough of the Humble stock that they could declare it. They got over 95% or something like that. Some legal way, they said, okay, we can now call in all the rest of it. So they gained 100% control of Humble in about 1965.
Okay, and so relatively recently then.
Yes. Yeah. And then we became SO Research and Engineering Company. They changed the name from Standard Oil Development Company to SO Research and Engineering Company. This is the research part of Standard Oil.
Mm-hmm. SO being abbreviation for Standard Oil.
SO, exactly. Yeah. And then in about 1970, they changed the name to Exxon because they were having trouble marketing under Esso in two or three states. I think Illinois was one of them, and Kentucky or Tennessee was one of them. That when the Standard Oil Company, the old Rockefeller Company was broken up in 1911. There was an antitrust action, and they broke up the Standard Oil Empire, and they went to Saucony Vacuum was one of them, and Standard of Indiana was one of them, and Standard of California, and all the Standard companies were broken up, and Standard of Ohio, and